a rainy evening like tonight often reminds me of the story of Dania, the cattleman. It's a little bit different than many of the other suttas in the canon, in that it is more of like a kind of song poem that goes back and forth between the voice of Dania, the cattleman, and the Buddha. And the setting is essentially on the banks of the Mahi River. Dania is on one side, and he is a kind of a well-established rancher. He's, you know, attained some sense of stability and security in his life and his vocation, and you know, feels confident in that and his ability to provide sanctuary for himself and his family, provide food, and is sort of exclaiming the virtues of that stability. And then on the other side of the river, you have the Buddha, who is homeless, wandering, ascetic, who's given up all kind of worldly stability and security for a peace of mind and an internal stability that he's proclaiming the virtues of on the other side. And I'll just read the first two stanzas. So Dania says, "The rice is cooked, the milking done. I live with my people along the banks of the Mahi River. My hut is roofed, my fire is lit. So if you want rain, God, go ahead and rain." And the Buddha responds, "Free from anger, my stubbornness gone. I live for one night along the banks of the Mahi River. My hut's roof is open. My fire is extinguished. So if you want rain, God, go ahead and rain." And for me, there are so many powerful and kind of beautiful things about this back and forth that they continue. And one of them, it's this sort of dual nature of what the Buddha is professing and exclaiming, which is on one hand pointing out the imperfect stability of Dania's life and the potential for loss and for worry and for stress and for anxiety, for all he's built up, you know, that it actually can be threatened, and the anguish that can create is very powerful and can be very overwhelming. And for all that he has abandoned, the Buddha has lost the ability to feel anguish, right? Lost the conditions under which he could feel threatened by anything. And so this profound security that he has attained and is professing our capacity to attain, all of us. And yet he's not condemning Dania. He's not hassling him. He's not sarcastic. He's not giving him a hard time. You know, there's an appreciation of, you know, the work and the care and the effort and the aspiration that someone like Dania might have. And so I think there's something very beautiful that in the end, you know, Dania, he, unlike some other stories, you know, he and his family, they don't become monks and nuns. They stay lay people, and they become devoted to the Buddha and his teachings. But there's this sort of respect for path and distinction and difference there, but also not letting go of the upholding of the utmost that the Buddha keeps pointing to. And so there are a lot of places where, you know, there are stories and teachings about just the anxiety and the stress and the fear and the oppression of creating a home, of whether it's the sort of householder life and life in the world and the sort of the compulsion to kind of keep trying to create stable conditions outside of ourselves to feel safe, to feel secure, to feel at peace. And the, you know, the nature of those being undependable, right? Being not ultimately secure, right? That no matter what conditions we set in place, that they're subject to decay, subject to change. There is this undependability at the heart of all phenomena. And so that there's the kind of external part of that, of how we start to see our efforts at creating sort of stability in our lives and stability around us, while can be very beautifully motivated, actually. Also, it's whatever faith we have in its ultimate satisfaction is folly, right? And is not going to actually be able to provide for that. And so that there's the external part and then also the internal part. This acknowledgement that we're not just creating a home outside of ourselves, not just trying to kind of constantly reestablish security outside of ourselves and in our lives, you know, at the boundary of the skin, but that internally we're in a constant compulsion also to be creating this solidity of self, this home, this sense of stability, and that it suffers from the same nature, right? That it is not stable. There's nothing there that we can create that actually lasts. And so if we're dependent upon that internal sense of self for stability, it's also going to keep generating more and more anxiety, more and more worry, more and more fretting, because it's disappearing every moment. Michelle mentioned the poet Han Shan earlier, and I was reminded of this poem of his. Cold Mountain is how his name is usually translated. So many kinds of people exist. Hundreds of plans for profit and fame. Hearts intent on glory. Always trying to get rich. Minds that never rest. Rushing about like smoke. Dependents gather round, one yells and 100 heads nod. But less than 70 years from now, ice becomes water and roof tiles break. Dead at last, all cares cease. Who will be their heir? Drop a ball of mud in the water and behold the thoughtless mind. There is a call to accept the nature of things, right? To stop trying to keep enforcing our worries and our will and our fears and our anxieties onto the world around us, the world inside of us, seeing how much strain and stress that can cause when it's motivated by those things, instead of care, instead of wisdom, instead of compassion and kindness, that there, we create all kinds of anxiety and madness. And yet, what is it to watch the nature of something unfold? What is the peace that comes with that? To stop fighting and stop resisting the nature of things, to decompose, to fall apart. Where is there the possibility of security in that? And so, of course, there's ways we can see that in the world and in our lives outside of ourselves. But here, you know, there's plenty of room to keep watching that. You know, we're up against it all the time. And it's one of those great things about being a yogi where you can sometimes see our, like, perseverating and our these engagements with other yogis or with, you know, staff or with beings outside nature, you know, like that are so evocative, you know, of these powerful forces in us. And, you know, you sometimes you get a sense of like, if you try to tell someone again, like back home, like how intense it was that whatever, you know, this person got in front of you or this, whatever it is, you know, it's just like, it's hard to convey the charge of it. Cause it's like, that seems like not a big deal, you know, given what's happening out in our most of our lives. But you see that we're actually, again, it's like these subtle things happening all the time that there is this sense of like exhaustion that can come from it. And this sense of like, oh my God, we're always in these sort of convulsions of, contraction around the undependability of phenomena around us. And, you know, and I just like this thing about, you know, this morning, that question, it's like, yes, you know, you have to get that. Of course, you know, it is cold and it's raining outside, and how beautiful it is that we have this space that we can come inside and that it's warm and there's lights and there's protection from the elements, that we're offered food. Right? It's not that the conditions don't matter. Of course they do. Of course we're trying to set as much supportive conditions as we can. And yet we see that it's never satisfied. You know, there's a part of our minds, a part of sort of the heart that's never fully satisfied. That's going to find dissatisfaction somewhere in it. And this, you know, that at some point you have to see that the conditions are never going to supply that. The conditions outside are never going to ultimately satisfy us. There's never going to be enough gluten-free bread, right? Or as Michelle was saying, those of us who are gluten eaters, it's starting to feel like there might not be enough gluten-y bread around. And that's and to really take that in and how actually intense that is, to really see that like we do care for ourselves and we want to have our basic needs met, and there's something very wholesome and beautiful about that. And yet there is also the sense of conditions are out of our control. You know, we're never going to get enough praise to feel worthy, right? We're never going to have enough you know, ice cream to make us feel totally satisfied, right? There's just like that as soon as a pleasant experience arises and we have the sense of satisfaction, we have the sense of stability for a moment, and then it's gone. And then, you know, there's some next thing. Is there another wanting, or does an unpleasant sensation arise? And what does that evoke? And, you know, we're in these streams of uncontrollable experience. And so, like, of course the heart contracts around that. Of course we don't feel that as stable because we don't have the skills, we don't have the training to be with life as it's actually unfolding. And that's mostly just what we see as yogis. When we sit down, we try to follow the breath, or we try to follow just life as it's unfolding, you just see that there are places where the mind can show up for it, and many places where it can't perfectly, right? And so it's just a matter of deepening that familiarity, deepening our intimacy with the uncontrollability, with the wildness and the wilderness internally and externally. And to know that that's a very slow, patient, difficult, often, and beautiful process, right? Where we do start to come into, you have places where you do see what it's like when it's loving kindness that's motivating your actions to take care of yourself or to take care of someone else. You know, the beauty of that. When there's wisdom behind, oh gosh, just moving out of a difficult, painful posture for a moment, you know, and giving yourself some respite. You know, these are our actions don't always have to be motivated by the worry, the fear, the anxiety. And yet it's really important to see when they are, right? To be in touch with that aspect of being that's very subtle. Then we start to try to be sensitive to these unfoldings. And so while part of that is learning this, you know, sensitivity to the goodness that we're capable of, and the kindness and the gentleness and the tenderness, to give us hope and inspiration and a sense of our worthiness, right? That's internal, that's just experiential. There also has to be a witnessing and a bearing of the intensity of our worries and our anxieties and how they're propelling us into the future, how we are continually trying to shore up this sense of me, this internal self-structure, out of, you know, fear and overwhelm with the flood of experience. It's important to do that, you know, it really was this essential part of the Buddha's liberation that he spoke of. You know, there are these phrases that are known as kind of his exclamations of these stages of his awakening, when he really started to see these underpinnings of the creation of this sense of self and how painful it is and how what a prison actually it was. He said, "Oh, house builder, you have been seen. You shall not build this house again. Your rafters have been broken up. Your ridgepole is demolished. My mind has attained the unconstructed, Nibbana, and reached the end of any sort of craving." So to see the relationship between this sense of insufficiency, the sense of longing, the sense of wanting, that's so subtle and yet so powerful in the heart, and how that creates this structure, this prison that we are constantly reinforcing as a sense of, as a way to feel stable, as a way to feel in control, and yet also this sense of how oppressive it actually is and how unnecessary it is, and how actually a deeper peace that allows things to fall apart, that allows for the unconstructed, the uncomposed, to actually be a more peaceful aspect of our experience. When he gets enlightened, he says, "Birth is destroyed. The holy life has been lived. Done is what had to be done. There's no more coming into any state of being." And so, you know, that can sound like a strange, in some ways, exclamation of liberation. Like, what is that notion that birth is destroyed? What does that mean, right? And it has to do with the oppression of the sense of becoming, of the way that our minds and hearts are so invested in next, in what's about to happen, and who, in the satisfaction we might get in a moment, who we might be in 10 years, the job we might have, the lover we might have, the family we might have, the conditions of our death, whatever, right? Or just like the next bite we're about to eat. Or this sense that, oh, something really super quiet is about to happen. And then the heart, you know, just crushes it. You know, and it doesn't crush that which doesn't exist. It crushes that quiet that's right here, right now, right? Because it's not enough. The sense of, oh, this is good, but there's better, right? It's like, oh, if only this little thing will unhook, and this, and that sense of when in the tradition, of course, there is the notion of rebirth and lifetimes and, of course, all of that framework. But it's not just about birth, life, and death in that frame. It's the birth, life, and death that's happening every moment. That there's not a sense of having to become again, to becoming next. That the sort of fully enlightened being, it's not that they stop being exactly, it's but they do stop becoming. Right, this fire, this anxiety, this strain, the stress, the sense of lack is gone. It's extinguished. You hear this language, right? This quietude, this peacefulness with the arising and passing of phenomena on their own, without a need to assert and invest and oppress the future through our worries, through our longings, through our wantings. And, you know, so many, you'll hear us in the interviews and you'll give a report and it'll be like some awful thing keeps, you know, plaguing you, you know? And then we're like so happy about that, right? We're like, yes, you know, that's great. Things are going great. And you're like, what are you talking about? You know, and it has to do with this. It's like this understanding that we need to develop a sensitivity towards our own weariness of this, right? That like actually we need to feel the pain of becoming, the tiredness of it, the exhaustion of it, the fruitlessness of it, the boredom of it, right? The just like, oh my God, this song just won't stop, right? And just like the relentlessness of our own minds has to be, you have to get a flavor of that. Of course, we also need to get a flavor of the beauty of the mind and the capacity for clarity and quiet and peacefulness and love, you know, so that like we really are trying to make sure that, you know, we have some spectrum of that for ourselves. Of course, it's out of our control. You know, some retreats are just easier. Some retreats are just a grind and we can't control that totally, but we have, you know, that's partly why we talk about, it's like, okay, if there's something really difficult, intense, you also need to find your way out of it at times, right? You need to go outside, get into nature, you know, have some beauty if it's not feeling like the beauty is internal, right? We need to be reminded of it and of our connection to it, our capacity for it, reminding ourselves of our sila, our ethical conduct commitments that we've made, right? And the beauty of that, of how we're caring for one another, that there's this like you know, we need to bolster the heart and mind to be able to then also bear witness to the dukkha of the mind, right? The hardship, the sorrow, sometimes the relentlessness of it. I was saying to one of the groups today, I remember, you know, when I was a kid, they had this like anti-drug campaign. It was, you know, the mind is a terrible thing to waste. And I remember in high school, there was like this heavy metal record that came out and it was, the mind is a terrible thing to taste. And I think about that all the time, you know, on retreat, you know, it's just like, oh man, what? It's so crazy. And it's such dukkha and it's so beautiful. And like, you have to have something that like has a little bit of levity to it because it can get very intense, you know, and that we need to actually feel that intensity, but it has to, there's a very delicate dance of where does that intensity and the dukkha of it propel us into spiritual aspiration? And then where does it sort of drain us and feel like into hopelessness and despondency and doubt? So that, you know, we do have to be careful about that process, but it shouldn't be enough to keep us from really dealing and showing up for the sensitivity there. The Buddha once came to a group of monastics and he asked them, what do you think? Which is greater? The tears you have shed roaming and wandering this long, long time, crying and weeping from being joined with what is displeasing, being separated from what is pleasing, or the water of the four great oceans. And they reply, as we understand the Dhamma taught to us by the Blessed One, this is greater. The tears we have shed while wandering and roaming this long, long time, crying and weeping from being joined with what is displeasing, being separated from what is pleasing, not the water of the four great oceans. And he gave them the thumbs up. He said, yes, excellent. This is greater. The tears you shed while roaming and wandering this long, long time, crying and weeping from being joined with what is displeasing, being separated from what is pleasing, not the water of the four great oceans. Long have you repeatedly experienced the death of a mother. The tears you have shed over the death of a mother while roaming and wandering this long, long time, crying and weeping from being joined with what is displeasing, being separated from what is pleasing, are greater than the water of the four great oceans. Long have you repeatedly experienced the death of a father, the death of a brother, the death of a sister, the death of a son, the death of a daughter, loss with regard to relatives, loss with regard to wealth, loss with regard to disease. The tears you have shed over loss with regard to disease while roaming and wandering this long, long time, crying and weeping from being joined with what is displeasing, being separated from what is pleasing, are greater than the water in the four great oceans. Why is that? From an inconstruable beginning comes samsara, this cycle of becoming and birth and death. A beginning point is not evident. Though beings hindered by ignorance and fettered by craving are roaming and wandering on, long have you thus experienced stress, experienced pain, experienced loss, swelling the cemeteries, enough to become disenchanted with all fabricated things, enough to become dispassionate, enough to be released. And so, you know, we have to see that the promise of this approach is not the sort of, it's not always what we project onto the notion of enlightenment, right? Or how we think we would be as an enlightened being. But this sense of peace and relief that comes from a wholesome disenchantment, that comes from this, like, watching these things over and over, watching the heart constantly just be grabbing on to what's happening or what's next, rejecting what it doesn't like, spacing out to what it can't deal with. The ability to see that and to tire of it, and to watch it so closely that we start to understand in a not a conceptual way, but in this deep systemic body mind way, where the mind doesn't have to stop doing anything. You don't have to make it stop doing anything. There is a natural loss of expectation of satisfaction from smell, taste, sight, touch, body, mind. Right, that we recognize that these phenomena that are rolling on because of conditions are never going to ultimately satisfy us, and so we don't hate them, we don't get rid of them, we don't are not at war with them, but we also don't expect satisfaction from them. We acknowledge that they are nature, that this whole being is nature, and that it arises and passes when conditions are such that they arise or pass. And that the peace and the release of stop being at war, stop putting the world outside of us into the prison of our own preferences, is an unshakable peace. That there's something there that, if deepened fully, is beyond conditions, right? That there is a peace, there is a satisfaction, there is a quenchedness beyond conditions. The Buddha, it's like, just by doing what we're doing, by watching thoughts over and over again, watching body sensations over and over again, you know, one sees as it really is with correct wisdom, thus, in the past and also now, all consciousness is impermanent, suffering, subject to change. And then sorrow, lamentation, pain, displeasure, and despair are abandoned. With their abandonment, one does not become agitated. Being unagitated, one dwells happily. A bhikkhu, a monk who dwells happily, is said to be quenched. And so there is something important about having some times where, of course, we recognize the beauty of love and the enthusiasm of just the fascination of this experience of mind and body and the energy and, you know, the wildness of it. And And to not be afraid of sense pleasure either, right? It's like, oh, to appreciate when things feel good and have compassion when things are hard. But there is also this quality of quenchedness, of relief and release that we also need to develop a taste for. And there is that process of where do we then rest? Where do we come to let this fire be extinguished, right? To let the fuel just burn itself out. Where is that quietude a place of safety and security? In the Bahia Sutta, the Buddha says, where water, earth, fire, and wind have no footing, there the stars don't shine, the sun isn't visible, the moon doesn't appear, and darkness is not found. And when a sage, through their sagacity, has realized this for themselves, then from form and formlessness, from bliss and pain, they are freed. Do we have a taste for that? Do we have a taste for the non-becoming, for the quietude? Not always, you know, it's like you most of the time, no, you know, we just want to be happy, you know, and we want things to be the way we want them to be. And that's fine, you know, we dance between this, like on both sides of the river, right? That there's the places where we're like Dania and there's this like, okay, we just kind of want to have our things together and that feels like pretty good. And then there are times where we have to acknowledge that there is something deeper, that there is a deeper peace that we're capable of and that actually a part of us longs for. And so that there's times where we have to explore that terrain and also recognize that there are going to be parts of us that are afraid of that. There's going to be parts of the self, of course, that are like definitely not. The sun doesn't shine. What? Right? Like, no, we want the sun, we want the moon, and we want the stars, and we just want things to be nice. And so, you know, of course, you know, of course, it's like you don't have to stress the self out, and we're trying to get rid of it, you know, we're trying to yank it out. It's like this, you have to appreciate that the sense of self is there as a protection. Right, all of these things that we think we're up against, greed, hatred, delusion, right, the big problems, we gotta really see that these are defenses against the uncontrollability of things. These flood of experience at each sense door that's happening that we can't just manage perfectly. And so, you know, craving, greed solidifies our grasping around pleasant experience, right? It's a way of trying to kind of slow that down and so that we're holding on to the good. And it works well enough that, of course, we get compelled by it and addicted to it. Aversion is a similar process of just kind of keeping away the unpleasant, you know, shoring up ourselves, doing all we can to defend ourselves from loss, from pain, from whatever. And again, that can work well enough that we keep being compelled by it. And delusion, the same. It's like things are just so hard to, it's so hard to watch this phenomena unfold moment by moment. And so we just sometimes need a break and we space out or we, you know, go into the fog or, you know, whatever it is, we don't see clearly. To understand that these are devices that the heart has learned to manage the overwhelm. And so we're not trying to just like yank those away and like stop being greedy and stop being angry and stop being deluded. You have to appreciate, we have to respect the defenses and understand that they'll only naturally stop asserting themselves when some other kind of defense, some other mechanism, some other capacity is strong enough, right? It's, if we don't need the defenses, they won't engage. And that only happens through the practice that we're doing, that trying to just keep watching clearly, slowly, carefully what's happening, watching moment by moment experience unfold, trying our best to be with the flood. When we can't, of course, we just narrow, okay, the breath, the hands, open to the body, open to sound, do loving kindness. You know, we have a range of method that we offer here. There are many other methods in even just within this Theravadan Buddhist tradition, all in the same spectrum of trying to kind of manage the flow of experience enough so that we have a chance of keeping up with it and seeing it clearly and seeing that things are undependable, you know, constantly moving, not coherent. And so because of that, there's like a liberation that comes from that. There's this sense of freedom and peace through that seeing. And when the mind is strong enough and subtle enough and soft enough and gentle enough and nimble enough and kind enough and energetic enough but calm enough and blah, 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 right? It's like, yeah, it happens. And you don't need anger and you don't need craving and you don't need delusion because everything's fine. And you really get that there's no problem. This upekkha, this equanimity. And you enjoy it when those conditions are there. And you really take the truth of it as real and as meaningful. And then we acknowledge that, yeah, the conditions then change and the energy goes down or the whatever, all of those many things, you know, how are dependent upon our assertion. But then there are moments of insight that do uproot elements of it so that there's like deepening understanding that actually stops reproducing it on deeper and deeper levels. And so that ultimately, yeah, we don't need to use the tools of greed, hatred, and delusion to feel safe, because that's all they're doing is helping us feel safe. James Baldwin, in an essay in the 1950s, wrote, "Any real change implies the breakup of the world as one has always known it, the loss of all that gives one an identity, the end of safety. And at such a moment, unable to see and not daring to imagine what the future will now bring forth, one clings to what one knew or dreamed one possessed. Yet it is only when a man is able, without bitterness or self-pity, to surrender a dream he has long possessed that he is set free, has set himself free for higher dreams, for greater privileges." It's such a perfect expression of this process and other processes that, you know, we're in as humans and society. But this sense of that we have to allow the breakup of all that we know and are familiar with. And we have to recognize that, of course, there's going to be a contraction around that. Of course, that doesn't feel safe initially. And yet the courage it takes and the strength, and I'd say, you know, the kindness and the sensitivity and the carefulness and the pacing in order to allow for this greater freedom, these higher dreams, how important it is and how we can find the strength internally to do that. Michelle yesterday was speaking about Myatong Sayadaw, who we knew in Burma, and talking about how he explained to her how he would do these guardian meditations. And so she spoke about the reflections on the virtue of the Buddha, the reflections on the 32 parts of the body, the reflections on loving kindness. And then the last one is reflection on death.
Which I didn't mention.
Which she did not mention. But you still have to hear about. And And so what he told, I'm going to tell Michelle's story, if I may, which I've heard a few times. What he told her was that if for the practice of reflection on death, the way that he had done it was a very simple, you know, similar to some of the other practices we do, like loving kindness or compassion. But he would just reflect in two ways. One, he would breathe in with the phrase, "Everyone I know will die." And try to really just take that in. And then on his exhale, reflect, "And I too will die. Everyone I know will die. And I too will die." And then he said, "And you know what? When I die, I'm not going to be surprised." Ah! And that's why it's a protection. Right? There is this sense of, like, why would reflection on death be a guardian, be a protection? How does that create the sense of safety? And it, again, it's breaking through our resistance to nature, to the nature of things, to this inevitability of our decomposition of body, of mind. And actually the peace that can come with that, the profound relaxation, right? The rest, the sense of how much are we fixated on the fear of death and the fear of dying. And what a relief it would be to come to peace with that. How beautiful an aspiration that is. How beautiful a practice. And yet to get that you don't just practice it alone. You practice it along with these other ones. So if you just look at, you know, you're practicing loving kindness and you're practicing the reflection on death. Practicing loving kindness and the reflection on death. The virtues of the Buddha, the 32 parts of the body, right? There's this like upliftment and sobering, right? It's uplifting and it's sobering. It's uplifting and it's sobering. And you can't just do one. Right, you have to understand the ways in which they're part of a package, they're part of a whole. They support each other, they strengthen one another, they purify one another. And you know, we knew him at, you know, this beautiful time in his life. He was getting quite elderly, and I remember going to his kuti at his monastery one day, and there was like this music really blaring outside, you know, his monastery. And, you know, I said, "Sayadaw, you know, does the music bother you at all?" And he was like, he's like, "Music?" He's like, "I can't hear anything. Ah." He's like, "I haven't been able to hear for years, you know." He's like, "I can barely see." He's like, "You know, it's all much easier." It was really, he was such a joy. And had this kind of levity and lightness and also real gravity and real serious and, you know, very potent and powerful and clear. And then about 4 years ago, he died. And it was hard. You know, I wasn't able to go that year. And, you know, it was one of those things where, you know, it would have been nice to see him again. But you take in, you know, the teachings and you take in the truth of all of these, you know, the undependability and the uncontrollability. And it's still been nice that ever since he passed away, they actually built another stupa, another pagoda up at the top of the hill that Michelle was talking about, kind of right next to the blue pagoda she was speaking of. And it's just been a really nice place for us to kind of go and visit when we're up there and just sort of pay respects and appreciate that there is something actually about his vibe that is still very present there and very clean and very, it's just this huge sense of just relief to be there. This winter, Darine and I were there with another friend of ours, and we were kind of walking up in the hills to just go visit, pay respects. And we went up to this new pagoda, and the new abbot of the monastery, who we've also known for many years, was up there. And he was very lovable and very gentle, friendly guy, and was really, you know, happy to see us. And as soon as we got there, he said, oh, come over, come and see Sayadaw. And we weren't sure about, like, the translation or exactly what, you know. And so he opened a door that was in this stupa. And as soon as he opened it, we saw that inside was a glass coffin. And Sayadaw's body was still there. And, you know, 4 years decomposed. And it was just quite, of course, intense and amazing and powerful. And then and then he said, oh, go in, you know, and there's little flashlights, you can look in, you know. And like, okay. And you crawl in, and it's like, there's Sayadaw, and he's lying, and he still had his glasses on, and it was mostly, you know, there was a lot of bone, but also plenty of not bone, and his robes and flesh and bugs and moisture, and just incredible. And I have seen animals, you know, in various states of decomposition, but never a human like that. And I just was so, so grateful to him for, you know, I couldn't say I know what his intention in his decisions around his burial were, but there's something very pure that came across about not magic, not anything fancy, but the willingness to continue to honor the decomposition, right? The non-assertion of a perfection, of self, of meanness, of how we're constantly constructing and composing ourselves, this honoring of the way we decompose and fall apart and disintegrate, and that's the strange beauty of that process. The beauty of not aesthetic beauty, but of the truth, right? That there's a beauty to the truth of it and to the honesty of it and the humility of it. And how important and powerful a lesson that still feels for me. It's still very resonant. And this question of, you know, when it's not just when we die, it's every moment, you know, we're so concerned and worried about dying, but really we should be worried about becoming. It's like, can we sit here in this body, in this moment, in this mind, these conditions, and just bear the reality of our own decomposition? Right, whether that has to do with age and the truth of that, or sickness and the truth of that, or just the way that we can watch the sense of me arise and pass, the contraction of the heart around experience, the uncontrollability of sound, of seeing, of smelling, of tasting, of body sensation, of the breath, of the mind. Where can we settle back and feel at peace with the decomposing self? Where do we find freedom in that? Where is the taste of liberation in that release? And a big part of it is going to be also bearing the intensity of the lack of peace, the lack of safety, the lack of acceptance of that, right? Of where we want to be, and we want to be in the next moment better. And, you know, we want to keep solidifying it, and the willingness to just bear the intensity of that, to let the heart and mind do that, right? There has to be some degree of letting it play out. We have to be able to watch it. We have to be able to watch the sense of self becoming created and dissipating, and the contraction and the release. You know, that there has to be some willingness to not just controlling it, not so uptight with the attention that it's trying to suppress it, right? Watching this happen, seeing it happen, bearing the beauty and the pain of it, and understanding that it's not just, we can't just force ourselves into enlightenment. We can't just force ourselves into acceptance of death. We have to be very gentle and tender with that process. There was, a time where I was on retreat and had one of these things where it was like, things felt like they were coming together, and I was getting concentrated, and it felt like, something's happening. And it's like, okay, you know, anyway, and you do this thing, you start to push, you start to strive, you start to kind of try to get the juice going. And then I could just see, it was vanishing. The quiet was vanishing, and there was like tension, my body was getting tense, and that like clenching my teeth and sweating, and you know, that whole, and you know, after however much period of time, there was just like no letting go, no acceptance, no release, just this like trying to make this thing happen, you know, trying to squeeze wisdom out of whatever, you know, was about to, you know, happen, my breath or whatever. And finally it just, you know, at some point I finally realized like the pain that I was creating for myself, that it wasn't working, and I had really worked myself up into this like very tense and tight, horrible thing that then led to, you know, shame, humiliation, sense of defeat, sense of inability, doubt, right? This like torrent of all of these things that we all, you know, encounter and find ourselves in relationship with at times. And so I was at that time able to just take a break and drove down to the ocean, just to try to do what I'm saying, right? It's like, get a little beauty, get a little bit of rest, get a little perspective, stop being so intense, you know, turn off the mindfulness, just like, okay, just rest and be nourished by something. And when I was there, I was able to see something that now I've seen a number of times. But this was the first time I had really seen it fully, which was, there was this young couple who had brought their baby to the beach, to the ocean, for what was clearly the first time. And there was just this excitement and, you know, tenderness and beauty of that approach and that introducing this little being to this wildness of the sea, and the beauty and the cold and the difference, you know. And so the father brought this baby, kind of waded into the water a little bit, and just gently introduced it to the water. And you could just feel the kind of the care and the carefulness and the tenderness of that. And the, you know, just the response of like, what is this? And the excitement and the confusion. And then at some point, the overwhelm, right? At some point, like not comfortable, and the baby starting to get scared and crying. And then the father just, of course, taking the baby back and holding it, right? Pulling it out of the water, protecting it, whispering to it, singing to it, caring for it. And then as the baby was soothed, bringing it back in the water, reintroducing, going through this process of introduction, of testing the waters, of feeling these new realms, of getting overwhelmed, and then being brought back into a safe sense of caring, of tenderness. And for me, it was just such this reminder of how I hadn't been treating myself that way, right? That I had this agenda for this kind of, you know, internal baby to just, you know, be, go toss it into the ocean, right? And like, be, just be one with things, right? And it's like, no, you know, it doesn't work like that. It's like, it's this slow, careful, tender process that by which we start to become a little bit familiar, right, with these unknown realms internally. When we get scared, we come back to safety, to kindness, to tenderness, to compassion, as long as we need. Sometimes it's humblingly long. Sometimes it's humblingly distant from the intensity, right? And then we reintroduce, we come back into the ocean, we come back into the wild, into the wilderness, slowly, slowly, right? We learn to swim, we learn our way, you know, deeper and deeper into the relationship with these elements of wilderness. And that I've seen it at the other end of life now there with very elderly people coming to the ocean, being brought by their grandchildren, you know, and so fragilely and so carefully, you know, with sometimes with canes and crutches or wheelchairs, of being just gently carried out, you know, held into the water and, you know, and dunked in with this love, this connection, this safety of someone to do it with, right? Someone that when we don't have the strength to pull ourselves out of the water, that there are these people around us who might help, who might give us that support and that bolster. How beautiful that is, and how actually so much of all of us in the middle terrain between infancy and total, you know, elderhood are lost in this arrogance of independence, right? This sense of not feeling like we can just kind of do it ourselves, and without that sense of connection and support, and how it's just not true, that actually we always need that. We always need the sense of support in this exploration. And so just to know, you know, this sense of, this is a, it's a wild ride, right? There's so much that we're trying to kind of build in relationship to. There's so much exploration. There's so much beauty and just these realms of the mind and body that are incredible and worthy of knowing and exploring, and yet also scary. And so this sense of wherever you can find the kindness and the tenderness and the compassion and the love that you need to provide for yourself at times, to understand that it's overwhelming, to understand that we need that tenderness, and then to also, when we can, acknowledge that it's like the beauty of this community we're in right now, right? Even if it's temporary, even if we don't really know people, this sense of being supported by one another, that everyone is trying to take care as best they can of the space, of the precepts, of the, you know, quality and protection that we're providing one another here. That's when we talk about in those chants, taking refuge in the Sangha, that's what this is. It's like feeling that sense of love for the others, feeling the sense of love from each other. You know, we hear a little bit in our groups about what other folks are going through. And it's like, it's humbling, it's beautiful, you know, to see the humanity of one another. We have to be able to really recognize the connection and that sense of how different we are and how we share these common confusions and hardships. And feel that sense of love for one another, love for ourselves, as much as we can, in order to give ourselves the strength, the buoyancy of mind, to be able to then also go into the unknown, to explore what is at our edge, to decompose as best we can. Just sit for a minute.